This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Just because Brexit wasn't enough, there is also news today on immigration and affirmative action and, oh yeah, Twitter. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the studios of Minnesota Public Radio today in St. Paul, Minnesota, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you along, everybody, as we always are. Our man in London, Stephen Beard, on the Brexit vote coming up in just a little bit. First, though, this was a busy, busy day at the Supreme Court of the United States. The justices let stand today in the first of a pair of cases that require the closely watched tag. They let stand a lower court ruling blocking President Obama's executive order protecting millions of illegal immigrants from the threat of deportation. As he does on days like these, the president went to the White House press room.
So, where do we go from here? Most Americans, including business leaders, faith leaders, and law enforcement, Democrats and Republicans and independents, still agree that the single best way to solve this problem is by working together to pass common sense bipartisan immigration reform.
Separately, then, today in a 4-3 ruling, the justices said that the University of Texas can indeed continue to consider race as one of the many factors in its admissions decision. It's a win for advocates of affirmative action at UT and for the relatively small number of other colleges and universities that have similar policies. It is, by the way, the fourth time in 40 years the High Court has upheld the consideration of race in admissions. But a wider impact? Yeah, I don't know. From the Education Desk at WYPR, Marketplace's Amy Scott starts us off.
When word of the decision got out this morning, higher education groups cranked out the press releases and the sound bites.
The decision is a home run for the University of Texas and a grand slam for higher education.
That's Terry Hartle with the American Council on Education. Out of about 4,500 colleges and universities in the country, he estimates no more than 200 explicitly consider race in admissions. And he doesn't expect that to grow much because, except in a handful of states that prohibit race-based affirmative action, schools that want to use it are already doing so.
Remember, the consideration of race in college and university admissions has been legal for a very long time. What the Supreme Court has said today is it continues to be legal.
Many schools have turned to other methods to achieve diversity, like increasing financial aid and recruiting at predominantly Black and Latino high schools. Stella Flores is a professor of higher education at New York University. She says when affirmative action policies are challenged in court, it does have a chilling effect.
When race is threatened, many institutions are likely to protect themselves and not use race. This might embolden them to at least feel comfortable using it, but it's not without accountability.
The court said universities must periodically address their diversity efforts to make sure they're not giving race more weight than they should. The decision could have implications beyond campuses. Michelle Asha Cooper is president of the Institute for Higher Education Policy in Washington.
Ultimately, higher education is one of the top producers of the workforce.
Research has found that half the country's leaders in business and government come from just 12 elite colleges and universities. If those institutions look more like the rest of society, diversity advocates say, so will the people in power. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Continuing on that theme, then, diversity and society, there is news that more than 30 tech companies have signed on to a White House pledge to increase their diversity. Tech's overall whiteness and its overall maleness isn't exactly new, so we asked Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer to see how this latest effort might play out.
The tech companies signing the pledge say they'll recruit and retain more diverse workers, publish data on how many women and minorities work for them, and invest in partnerships to build a pipeline of diverse tech talent. Candace Morgan is head of diversity at Pinterest.
Our goal around hiring is to hire 30% women software engineers.
That is, Pinterest wants 30% of the software engineers they hire this year to be women. They're aiming for 8% in minority hires. Right now, fewer than 1% of Pinterest software engineers are African American.
They're still just getting started.
That's Wayne Sutton, co-founder of Change Catalyst, which offers training for tech companies' diversity staff. Sutton wants a culture change.
And we all know the tech industry moves fast. It moves fast on innovation. Why can't it move fast on this?
Pinterest Morgan says there's a pipeline problem. There just aren't enough women and minority tech graduates. Kimberly Bryant is founder and CEO of Black Girls Code, a nonprofit that introduces minority girls to tech. Bryant says the pipeline may be part of the problem, but tech companies also need to change recruiting.
They either recruit at only the top universities. They rely heavily on referrals from current employees, which tends to lock people of color out.
Bryant says the pledge is a good step, but now she wants to see action plans from these tech companies on the next step. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Not that they always know, but traders today seem to be pretty firmly in the Bremain camp. I love saying that. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The people, the British people, that is, have spoken. In, out, stay or go, a united Europe or not. Polls over there are now closed. The die are cast, as it were. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is in London. He's been on the story for us all the past couple of months. We've got him on the line. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Kai.
Give me, first of all, would you, the mood answer, right? What's the mood over there today?
Relief. That this
here too. How about that?
Yeah, this long, never-ending, acrimonious campaign is over. However, this is tinged with fear and anger. Fear that if there is a Brexit, it'll crash the UK economy, and anger on the part of the Brexiters that they've been ganged up on by the British establishment, and as a result, the UK may stay in the EU, and as they see it, be dragged down by this failing, crisis-torn project.
Lots of chatter about how much turnout is going to matter. Weather, as we know, is always critical in voter turnout. It was raining in parts of that country today. Hard, right?
Yeah, very much so. In the southeast of England, very hard in London, which has cheered up the Brexiters because London is a hotbed of Remainers. And the hope, the Brexiters' hope, is that the rain will have kept some of those voters at bay. A low turnout generally is thought to be good for Leave, good for Brexit, because these people are regarded as more committed to their cause. They're more passionate about it. And the idea is they'll vote come what may, and therefore they'll represent a bigger percentage of voters if the turnout is low. So heavy turnout, conversely, should be better for Remain. But we won't know until really very early in the morning how big the turnout has been.
Right. No official exit polls over there. The markets do, though, seem to have a vote, yeah?
Yes, absolutely. And this is at odds with the opinion polls. I mean, the Financial Times poll of polls last night put Remain on 48% and Leave on 46%. So it could go either way. I mean, too close to call. But as you say, financial markets have got the bit between the teeth. They've decided that Remain will win the day. The stock market ended in positive territory today and the pound was up, bearing in mind that George Soros, who knows a thing or two about currencies,
about
predicted
the British pound,
a 20% decline in the event of, for the pound in the event of Brexit. So clearly the money men and women say it's going to be Remain. It's all over, bar the shouting. But there'll be plenty of that tomorrow, whatever the result is.
Stephen, we've got a minute left. You were around in 1975, right, when the Brits sort of had a reaffirmation of joining the European Union, right? There was a referendum then.
Yes, indeed. I wasn't actually here then. I was in Canada at the time, but
I remember it at a distance. Yeah. How's it different this time? It seems like it's a different thing.
Very much so. And the point is that it's 40 years on, and a lot of those people who voted, and they voted overwhelmingly to stay in the European Union or the European Economic Community, as it then was, a lot of those people who voted in 75 to stay in now say the scales have fallen from their eyes. They're very unhappy about this project now, and they've turned to the Brexit camp.
Stephen Beard in London. We'll hear more, obviously, on this story tomorrow after the votes are counted. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you, Kai.
All right. Talk soon. Coming up.
Our clients have hard lives.
The latest from our newest podcast, The Uncertain Hour. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials up 230 points. That is the crazy happy music, by the way. 1.3%, 18,011 is the number. The NASDAQ gained 76 points, about 1.6%, 4910. The S&P 500 up 27 points. 1.3%, 2113 on your dial. It is July, and finally, we have our first big tech IPO of the year. Twilio is the name. Let me say it again and get it right. Twilio, it makes software that supports apps like WhatsApp. Shares opened at $15, closed up 99.0%. You need to drill an oil well in, say, 7,500 feet of water, then you might call Pacific Drilling, which operates deepwater rigs in the Gulf of Mexico and off Nigeria. Energy stocks popped today. Pacific Drilling, too, up 4.6%. Atwood Oceanics does the same business around the world, up 7.5%. United States Lime and Minerals, off 0.2%. Just thought I'd throw that one in there. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note, up. Get a load of this, 1.74%. Can you say Bremain? Sure, I knew you could. This is Marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. This past spring, the NFL, the National Football League, signed a deal with Twitter that would let the company live stream 10 Thursday night football games this coming season. Twitter paid $10 million for the privilege. Recently, it's begun selling ads that fans will see alongside that live stream as they tweet during the game. Thing is that Twitter gets a ton of fan traffic during big games, and if this little experiment is successful, could give that company a much-needed boost. Ashley Milne-Tite has more on that.
Twitter's partnership with the NFL could be coming at just the right time. David Campanelli is Executive Vice President of Video Investment at Horizon Media.
Twitter is absolutely in a phase where they need to really define who they are and what they're about, and their strengths very much lie in supplementing live events, sports being a huge part of that.
Simon Ogus, co-founder of the site sporttechie.com, agrees. He says the deal is a boon for advertisers because it's so easy to get data on Twitter users, where they live, what their interests are, as just one example.
So Twitter is going to be able to sell a lot of local ad spots that they can, you know, target specific people that are watching in, you know, San Francisco.
Jessica Liu is a senior analyst for Forrester Research. She says Twitter has tried to imitate other social platforms like Facebook, but she says what makes the social network so distinctive is its real-time quality.
you're able to catch live updates as fast as they are happening. In fact, some people turn to Twitter before they'll turn to Google search to get news about some breaking news story.
And it's that that makes it the perfect live event partner. She says Twitter and advertisers will do this more often, and not just at football games. She says think about the explosion of tweets and opportunity around the Olympics or even the Oscars. I'm Ashley Milne-Tight for Marketplace.
This summer, August specifically, will make it 20 years since welfare reform, when Bill Clinton and a Republican Congress overhauled what had been a cash assistance program for poor families and put in its place a new system known as Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. The biggest change was that under TANF, as the shorthand became, states would control their own welfare spending. Chrissy Clark from our Wealth and Poverty Desk has been on a road trip of sorts for our newest podcast, The Uncertain Hour, following the money to see just how states are using the $16.5 billion they get every year in federal block grants. Today's stop is Indiana.
I've just pulled into the parking lot of a CVS pharmacy to look at a billboard, bright pink background, with the close-up of a concerned, seeming woman looking into the distance.
It says, pregnant, we can help. Then it gives their phone number, and at the bottom it just says, Women's Care Center, free ultrasounds, free pregnancy tests.
The person showing me this billboard is Brandy David, 26 years old, works as a property researcher at a title company. One day, 2 years ago, she called that phone number when she found herself pregnant and needing help.
My first thought was, oh my God, damn it, no. Just all of those things, just all at once. I'd been using protection, and I was just like, why? Why? Why?
Brandy was in her first year of graduate school, barely making ends meet already. And she says she immediately knew she was in no position to have a baby.
I couldn't afford it. I was not dating the gentleman in question. I'm already in the hole from student debt while I'm in school.
Brandy says she knew she wanted an abortion, and she thought she knew where she could get one. Women's Care Center, that place with the billboard she kept driving by. Brandy set up an appointment, came in as soon as she could.
And it's set up in this beautiful old house, very homey. I walked in and saw how pink and fluffy everything in that room was.
At the appointment, she made it clear why she was there.
The lady was very friendly, supportive, but when I said that I wanted an abortion, she kind of shied away from that. She would just kind of keep telling me, like, well, we can get to that. Adoption's an option. There are other things that we can talk about, and, you know, we'll get to that sooner or later.
But her counselor never did get to that. In fact, Brandy didn't know it at the time, but there was no way she would receive an abortion at Women's Care Center or even get a referral for an abortion. Because it turns out Women's Care Center is what some call a crisis pregnancy center, a pregnancy resource center with a specific mission that includes steering women away from having an abortion. It also turns out the place Brandy went to and its anti-abortion efforts have been partly funded since late 2014 by a small percentage of federal welfare dollars through the program Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. Now, before we go any further, let me acknowledge that abortion is one of those intense emotional issues that probably every one of you listening right now has strong feelings about. Right now, in this story, we're going to look at a very specific question, the role of spending some federal welfare money on these alternative to abortion centers. Centers like this one.
So this is just our waiting room.
Jenny Hunsberger is vice president of Women's Care Center. Earlier this spring, she showed me around one of the offices they have in South Bend. Brandy was right. It is very pink, very homey.
We just want people to feel welcomed and cared for and comfortable and safe.
Jenny tells me this network of women's care centers has been around for more than 30 years. The typical client is poor.
Almost all qualify for federal programs like Medicaid. Nearly 80% are single moms. 25% don't have a high school diploma. 40% are fully unemployed. So our clients have hard lives.
I asked her, if a woman like Brandy, the grad student, feels like she just can't afford to have a child and says she wants an abortion, would you refer them to an abortion clinic?
What I would say is we would be here if any woman said that. Whatever a woman says, we would say to her, we are here for you before your decision, during your decision, and after your decision, regardless of what your decision is.
But am I correct that you would not refer them?
What I would say is that what we say to women is we are here for you before, during, and after. And the decision is yours.
But I just want to make sure I'm clear. But would you ever refer them to a clinic? No.
Correct. Or am I wrong?
What I would say is we would be here for you. And what I would say to a woman is I would be here for you before, during, and after. The decision is yours.
So you're not going to give me the information, but you will tell me that you will be here for me.
We will be here for you. We will be here for you always. We are here to serve you.
And though Jenny wouldn't say it explicitly, it's written into the contract with the state of Indiana that in order to receive TANF money, federal welfare money, centers like hers are forbidden from referring people to abortion clinics. Those are the conditions of their government funding. In case you were wondering, current law prevents federal money of any kind from funding abortions, except in cases of rape or incest or when the pregnancy will endanger the woman's life. But here in Indiana, the state spends federal money on efforts to steer women away from abortions. Specifically, over the last year, it's allocated $3.5 million federal welfare dollars to organizations like Women's Care Center. There's a common critique of single mothers on welfare that goes like this. If you're too poor to support a child, you shouldn't be having one in the first place. And so I asked Jenny why welfare dollars should be used to help and encourage poor, often single mothers, to have children. She said her program is more than that.
It really helps build families that are more self-sufficient, families that have more opportunity. So in that way, it's very appropriate.
The center also actively connects women to charities and government services.
Make sure that she has all of the resources she needs to navigate the Medicaid system, that she signed up for WIC, which is the Federal Nutrition Program for Pregnant Women and Children.
And food stamps, and of course, cash welfare. Indiana isn't the only state that puts federal welfare dollars towards alternative to abortion centers like Jenny's. So do Texas, Missouri, North Dakota, Ohio, and Pennsylvania. That's where the whole idea got its start, with a nonprofit organization called Real Alternatives. We reached out repeatedly to Real Alternatives for an interview, but they declined. Jerry Bermelin was a Republican state legislator in Pennsylvania when the idea for Real Alternatives was born.
We, in the pro-life movement, saw that there was TANF funds available, and that was one of the reasons why we created the organization, is because we knew that it could access the TANF funding.
That is, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families funding. As Jerry said this,
it could access the TANF funding.
I wondered how states justified putting welfare money into alternative to abortion programs. On the one hand, these programs do provide assistance to poor pregnant women and their soon-to-be families. On the other hand, these programs often encourage poor, single women to have kids, when one of the explicit goals of federal welfare reform was to promote the formation of two-parent families. I asked Jerry Bermelin about all this.
Yeah, and I don't think the answer is ever to kill the children just so they don't have to be on welfare. I don't agree with that philosophy. I think life is very precious and ought to be protected, and Real Alternatives helps to do that. And I do not accept the argument that we should just have them have their abortion so they're not on welfare. I feel that's very dehumanizing.
Jerry's also a fiscal conservative. He believes in limited government spending, shrinking government programs. So, yes, he thinks that it makes sense for welfare dollars to go to alternative to abortion centers. But he cautions,
it's not the taxpayers' responsibility to raise everybody's children for them, and I'm not suggesting that. What I'm suggesting is if you go through a crisis pregnancy and you really need help for a short period of time, usually it's only a few months, then I think we should be in the business of helping these people through those crisis pregnancies and getting them back on their feet.
And in doing that, the umbrella group Real Alternatives says they save taxpayers millions of dollars by connecting women with things like prenatal care and immunizations. When I told Brandy David, who went to the Women's Care Center thinking she could get information about an abortion there, that it was funded partly by welfare dollars, she was surprised.
That's just not okay, dude. Like, find something else. Like, there are a million other things that it could go to. It could go to supporting the children that are a result of this.
As for Brandy's particular situation, she did eventually realize that Women's Care Center was not going to help her with an abortion. She called a Planned Parenthood in another state to help her find a clinic that would. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
You can hear the rest of Chrissy's story on this week's episode of The Uncertain Hour. It's available wherever fine podcasts are distributed. Also, go on your own road trip. See how your state spends its welfare dollars. You can do that at marketplace.org. Final note on the way out today, or notes, I should say, musical notes. A federal jury in Los Angeles ruled today that the British rock group Led Zeppelin did not steal the opening notes of their classic rock anthem Stairway to Heaven from the late musician Randy Wolf. So as we await the Leave Remain decision across the pond, an epic musical Brexit right now. Composed officially now, the court says so, by Robert Plant and Jimmy Page. All right, we got to go. The Dow up 230 points today, 1.3%. The NASDAQ up 76 points, 1.6%. The S&P 500 up 27 points, about 1.3% there as well. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, George Judson, Suzanne Levy, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM. Hey, everybody, it's Kai. We wanted to introduce you to a new podcast from Marketplace brought to you by the Wealth and Poverty Desk. It's called The Uncertain Hour. You could think of it as a docupod. It dives deep into the uncertainties of our economy in ways you don't often hear. We think, well, we know, actually, you're going to enjoy it. Also, it's not actually an hour, more like, you know, standard podcast length, 20, 30 minutes. All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.